This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Good morning, guys. I'll get to the point right away. I'm retiring for good.
That is Tom Brady. He's retiring again. The longtime New England Patriot and NFL quarterback says it's for good this time. The 45-year-old is hanging it up after a 23-year professional football career, and that's not including 4 years of college football at my alma mater, the University of Michigan. If he is to be believed, then love him or hate him, it is the end of an era. So joining us now on the line, Chad Finn, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Chad.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So is he to be believed, Chad?
I believe him. Yeah, this seems sincere and genuine this time, and doesn't seem like there's any unfinished business or things like that. And of course, he's gone through some changes in his personal life that probably have affected his thought process a little bit. But it does seem like this second retirement is also the final one.
So for those who don't know, he has now, he and his former wife, Gisele Bündchen, have divorced. There was a lot of public conversation about that being related to his decision to unretire and play another year of pro football last year. You said there's no unfinished business this time, but, you know, Super Bowl hasn't even happened yet. And there was chatter about other teams that wanted him and where he could have taken, you know, one more pass, Chad.
Yes, and there were good fits out there for him, which is one of the surprises of this. He grew up a San Francisco 49ers fan. Joe Montana was his hero. He was at one of the more famous games in NFL history as a kid before he started playing in them himself. And it seemed like a perfect end to his career for him to go there for one season and help a team that really reached the NFC Championship game this year and was a healthy quarterback short of making a trip to the Super Bowl. It looked ideal for him to wrap up his career there and would have been a nice little coda on everything. So, but he decided that wasn't the path he was going to take.
So was this a surprise today when I saw the news? I was like, God, I wonder, did the sports columnists and other folks know or was everyone surprised when he got up this morning, according to his video, and said, well, let me just tell the world I'm retiring?
Yes, everyone was surprised. He has a TV deal lined up with Fox Sports for when his career ends. And from what I understand, they were surprised. They have the Super Bowl this year and weren't expecting him to be part of their coverage or anything like that. And he probably still won't be. But they were caught off guard by his retirement and they're his next employer. So I think everybody else was as well. And as I said, there are a lot of opportunities out there for him to play had he decided to take that pass. So yeah, a lot of people surprised.
Just a couple more quick questions, Chad Finn. First, I think that a lot of people fantasize that somehow he would retire in a Patriots jersey, but that just wasn't to be.
Teams like to do that ceremonial one-day contract thing where a guy comes back for one last little goodbye with the team that he's most associated with. I'm not sure if the Patriots will do that or not. I think it would be totally up to Brady, but you know the Kraft family that owns the team would love to do that. But
so it could happen.
It could happen. It didn't make sense for him to come back and play here, though. The team's not close to a Super Bowl contender right now, and that's probably the only thing that was still fueling him to play was to win another championship.
So, Chad, just a little bit more sound from his announcement today. Here we go.
I know the process was a pretty big deal last time, so when I woke up this morning, I figured I'd just press record and let you guys know first, so I won't be long-winded. Like, you only get one super emotional retirement essay, and I used mine up last year, so I really thank you guys so much to every single one of you for supporting me.
So setting aside the let you guys know first, because that basically means the entire planet in the world of social media, you know, there are icons and then there is the icon. And in football, he is the icon. So who does football turn to next for that rock star? Is it Patrick Mahomes of the Kansas City Chiefs who's headed to the Super Bowl again?
I think that's it. I mean, Brady is the most successful team sport, male team sport athlete of modern times. So you can really say there will never be a Tom Brady and another Tom Brady. And there's a great chance that you'll be correct down the line. But Patrick Mahomes is the closest thing. Just 5 seasons as a starter so far, but he seems to be in the Super Bowl every year like Brady used to be, and is piling up the accolades. If he wins another couple of championships or two, he's the next to the throne for sure.
All right, sports columnist for the Boston Globe, Chad Finn, as we all react to the second retirement of Tom Brady. Chad, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, in an entirely other part of the news and sort of the world, out with the old and in with the new seems to be the mantra of the state Republican Party today here in Massachusetts after narrowly voting for a new state party chair. Last night, incumbent Jim Lyons was running for a third term, lost to state committee member Amy Carnevale in a vote that was 37-34 on the ballot that closed it. Now, that 3-vote margin underscores tension that remains as the party seeks to shake off financial woes and massive election losses in order to move forward. So we're going to start with just a minute with Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the state Republican Party from 2009 to 2011. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've talked to you a bunch, Jennifer. You have been very clear that you felt this was the outcome that needed to happen. So today, I just want to get a minute and say, okay, so now Amy Carnevale puts one foot in front of the other. What are her top priorities? Let's use that old 100-day mark. What are her top priorities?
You know, it's funny. It's one of those things that, you know, you want to win, and then you win, and then you go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Now what did I get myself into? Right. And so I'm sure that, you know, is a little bit of what Amy's probably feeling this morning of, you know, I did it and this is great, but now the real work has to begin. And so the first 100 days is really cleaning up the mess, right? It's saving the passengers from the Titanic, you know, the final resting place. It's making sure that, you know, going through all of the documentation at the party, seeing what resources are really there. You know, that's number one, being able to keep the lights on, being able to hire a good chief of staff, you know, executive director, being able to hire a finance director, be able to hire a political director. So figuring out how you're going to do all of that. Going to the donors is the next thing, and making sure that they understand that you can do what you promised that you said you're going to do, which is right the ship and start winning elections again and legitimize the Republican Party in Massachusetts and gain their trust and faith. And then after that, you know, it's, I mean, 100 days, that's probably enough. And, you know, there are local elections in there. If there are a couple of local elections that the party can win, that would be great, even though they're nonpartisan races. You know, but start being able to grab some candidates that are winning candidates. It is, you know, as you started, it was a very tight margin. It is going to be very difficult to unify the party so soon. I think she is, you know, she said in her speech last night that she was going to go out and speak to all of those state committee members and try to unify the party. And I think that is a great strategy, because those state committee members are part of the committee, you know, and whether they agree with her or not, they are part of it. And this is a team that has to come together and has to start putting together a better strategy. And it's going to take everyone involved.
All right, Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the Massachusetts GOP, giving us that kind of 100-day agenda. Jennifer, thanks so much. I know we'll talk to you more as we follow her work in the months to come.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. So joining us now, WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown, who was there last night, and here in Studio 2, Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld. Steve, Joe, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So, Steve, give us the rundown of what it felt like in the room last night. This was close. I mean, 37-34, not on the first ballot. Was it tense?
It was tense, but it wasn't as contentious as I had expected. You know, there's been a lot of sniping between both sides of the party for weeks. And I get the sense that most folks we're tired of that, and we're ready to just say, okay, where do we go from here? And you know, the vote was close, but in the end, Carnevale was victorious.
So not contentious, Joe Battenfeld. I mean, there have been some contentious state party meetings that, in fact, led to there not being state party meetings for a while because they couldn't even get a quorum. You wrote a piece yesterday saying this is about party identity. So what do you make of the 37-34 split here when Jim Lyons was so administratively controversial,
right,
as well as politically so?
I mean, I think, honestly, it's going to take years for the party to get over these fractures. They're so embittered right now and so divided that they're, you know, Amy Carnevale has an almost impossible job to unite this party. There's still a big faction of committee members and voters who are in the Lyons camp. And they're going to have to be sort of unified into the more moderate sections of the party. And there's still a lot of divisions, a lot of bitterness going on. You know, the questions about money, as people mentioned, like, does the party even have enough money to pay for a staff at this point? It's going to be very difficult. I don't know. I don't think they do. So, You know it's bad when the Democrats put out a press release last night praising the outcome. It's sort of like a pity press release saying, oh, thank you, nice vote, guys, you know, hoping it would lead to more civility in the discussion.
I heard a little chuckle from you there, Steve, and I want to pick up on the money point that Joe Battenfeld was just making. We know that at one point recently they had nearly $100,000 in unpaid bills, and the latest update is that the party has less than $40,000 in the bank. My understanding is that Carnevale wants to hire someone, right? My understanding is she addressed this.
Yeah, she wants to professionalize the party. Basically, over the past 4 years, it's been Jim Lyons and some of his supporters doing things. You know, in the past, most parties have an executive director and people who deal with the finances and things like that, professionals that handle all those things. And she promises she's going to get those systems back into place. Of course, you got to pay for those things. The people don't do those jobs for nothing. So, with $35,000 in the bank, she's not going to be able to hire a lot of people right away. So she does have to reach out to folks who gave money in the past to the party, who may have not appreciated Lyons' scorched earth policy of administering the party. And hopes that those folks will take her call and maybe start contributing to the party again.
Let's hear.
Running for this position, I did receive commitments from previous donors to the party that they're ready to re-engage and commit resources to the party moving forward. So, I've been encouraged by those conversations, and I'll certainly be reaching out to those donors to ask for their help and their commitment to engage again in the party.
And that was Amy Carnevale talking to you last night, Steve, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, she wants to reach out. And as a matter of fact, last week there was a wealthy donor who wrote to committee members who said that he would make a big donation to the party if they dumped Jim Lyons. So I wouldn't be surprised if Amy Carnevale is on the phone to that donor today.
So that brings me to this next question then, Joe Battenfeld, which is, you know, usually you got to kind of sell your leadership. This is what I stand for. You've been talking about the party identity issues. Carnevale is known as a Baker Trump Republican. It raises the question, what does it mean to be a conservative in Massachusetts?
Right. Well, that's what they're going to have to struggle with, because you mentioned a Baker Trump Republican. There's really no such thing. There's no, linking those two right now. I think it's helpful that Amy Carnevale did reach out to more moderate members of the state committee and more moderate members in the party in an attempt to sort of unify things and make it more appealing for more moderate candidates to run. They've got to have to recruit candidates, number one, after they get some money, because they need way better candidates than they've had right now. And so hopefully they can start recruiting candidates, you know, and start with these sort of state legislative races. Start low. Start the bar low, because it's going to be very difficult for them to, like, go after state office. Nothing's going to change immediately because of this vote. just because there's a new person at the helm.
So we're talking with Joe Battenfeld, Steve Brown, about the outcome of the vote for party chair in the Mass GOP last night. Yesterday, we sort of looked ahead at that vote. Now we're debriefing it. Steve, Joe talked about the response of the Democratic Party here in the state, but I understand that the National Republican Party had a response to Amy Carnevale unseating Jim Lyons as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ron Kaufman was there, and Ron is the treasurer of the National Party. He has been Mr. Republican in Massachusetts for as long as I can remember. He's been at the center of things for quite a while. He's not really an ideologue. You know, he's a conservative. He wants to see money saved and things like that. But I wouldn't say he would be an ideologue. I had asked him if there's room for Charlie Baker Republicans and how does the party draw them back. Here's what he had to tell me.
There's room for all Republicans and right-thinking Democrats and all those wonderful independents in our party. I'm convinced that we do represent a conservative bent. I honestly believe that most of the state is where most Republicans are, which is fiscally conservative and moderately liberal on some of the social issues.
Now, Ron Kaufman then told me that he thinks the party is right more than wrong, and he says he is convinced that the new leadership will be good for the party.
So, Steve, I appreciate that, and I'm going to turn to Joe now, but with some of the other sound that you brought us from last night. So, Steve, Joe spoke with Tom Mountain, a Republican State Committee member, last night, and here was Tom Mountain's description of what he hopes is now the future of the party here in the state.
We have to get out the message that we are the party for everyone in the Commonwealth. We are the party of inclusiveness. We are the party for every man, woman, and teenager over the age of 18. And all are welcome in our party. And for those who have been disenchanted the past few years, the one thing I have to say is the Massachusetts Republican Party is here for you. We're back.
Let me just let you react to that, Joe.
I don't think the Republican Party is back by any means. Right now, they're losing people, as Democrats are, to the unenrolled party. People are flocking away from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to unenrolled. So that's going to continue. They're not going to be able to stop that from happening. So they're only at 9% right now in the entire state. So they've got to appeal, and I do agree with Ron Kaufman that they have to appeal to more independent voters coming up in these elections coming up, and as well as, but without, I wouldn't want the party to be so like turn into a Democratic light where there's no opposition, where they just take similar positions that the Democrats do. I think they have to stake out a clear alternative to the Democrats.
So, Steve Brown, last note to you, picking up on what Joe Battenfeld just said, both parties are losing enrollment in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And, you know, we've worried in the past about sort of the nationalization of local politics. Is this a moment for individual candidates versus parties to take the front seat for winning strategies and then, you know, elections over the next few years?
Sure. You have to appeal to the independents, people who are not a member of either party. They might lean one way or the other. But most of the voters in Massachusetts are unenrolled. So they're up for grabs. They can vote in either the Democratic or the Republican primary. So, you know, they got to get some attractive candidates. Republicans need to get some attractive candidates in order to get independents to pull a Republican ballot in the primary and weigh in on that.
All right. WBUR Steve Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald, thanks to you, too.
Thanks for having me.
3 years ago today, things started to change for us here in the Commonwealth.
Tonight, a rapidly evolving public health emergency, with Massachusetts confirming its first case of coronavirus in Boston, the eighth in the U.S. so far. The patient, a UMass Boston student in his 20s, who visited Wuhan, China.
Sound there from NBC News, February 1st, 2020. Now, today, there have been more than 2 million confirmed cases in the Commonwealth and just under 22,000 deaths. We've gone through surges, variants, openings, closings, and now in just 3 months from now, the federal coronavirus public health emergency will be over. So history has unfolded with us in it. And one archivist from the city of Boston has been quietly collecting bits of it for posterity. Here now to talk about that archive, Marta Crilly, archivist for reference and outreach for Boston City Archives. Welcome back, Marta.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to admit, it's still hard to hear that. It's hard to hear that sound.
It is. It is. It's very recent history.
And how do you think about, all right, let's illustrate this, right? So you're collecting these pieces as you go along, as we're living in history, which keeps coming back at us like that did. Give us an example of something that you've collected in this archive in our lives over the last 3 years that kind of embodies how and why you do this.
Well, I think that one piece of this history that we have that really struck me as I was looking through the things we have collected a few weeks ago is a video that we have of Mayor Walsh in March or April of 2020. And it's a video, they were recording the mayor for social media, but there are some outtakes. And in one of the outtakes, it's discussed how they're going to disinfect everything that the mayor has touched. But in that video, no one is wearing a mask. And it reminded me of a moment I had forgotten about, a moment where we were very careful about disinfecting things, but we were not wearing masks. And I think that that's important because human memory is fallible. And so it's important for us to collect records that were made in the moment to remind us of how things were.
So I'm going to play that sound. So this was sound, and later I'm going to play you the sound, the sound of Marty Walsh actually reading the children's book. But for now, I want to get to this little aftermath part that you're talking about.
That was a tough book, but I'll see you again soon. Have a good night, everybody. I wash my hands anyway. Okay. Where everybody?
So here's two things that are striking to me about that. One is it just underscores what you said, right? This is a moment where, given what we know now, I look back, we're not wearing masks and we're frantically disinfecting groceries, right, and the mail. But also, the work of an archivist is to capture those moments too, right? Because that history was happening and the rest of us didn't know it. And how do you find and know to capture those pieces?
Well, one thing that is really important about working for the City Archives is that we made sure during the pandemic to continue with our regular business processes of transferring records. So these digital records are records that would always be transferred to the City Archives. We discovered that it's really important to keep up with our usual work of transferring these electronic records. And in a period like COVID, those records become especially important because they do capture these little moments behind the scenes that are very important for understanding that particular historical moment and what it was like to be there. Even though it might not seem significant to have these 15 seconds of the mayor and his staff discussing disinfecting children's books, but it really captures what it was like to be in that time when, you know, as you said, when we're all washing our mail, but not wearing masks.
Right. So it's interesting. Part of what you also steward is an archive from 1918 and the flu pandemic and it broke out in the fall of 1918 in Boston. You talk about this process of storing records, you know, when you sent us over, but bear with me. So when you sent us over stuff from now, right, from the last 3 years, it included things like, you know, files from Joyce Linehan, who was, when Marty Walsh was mayor, was the chief of policy. John Barrows, then chief of economic development. They're policy documents. We're going to do this. We're opening this. Our statement is this. We're going to require this. And I kind of got that until I saw some of the records that were saved from 1918. Snatches of school committee or school reports, little pieces of newspaper cut that seem mundane, but that made me realize exactly how people were thinking and feeling, how many nurses were sick at the given time. And it's 100 years from now, as much as anything, that this matters, right?
Exactly. And I think the records that we have from the 1918 pandemic, that was a huge event in Boston's history. Over 675,000 people in the United States died during that pandemic. Over 4,000 Bostonians died. And as you said in those records, we see similarities between what happened in COVID in terms of huge influx of patients in the hospital, staffing shortages, schools are being closed, houses of worship are being asked not to meet, crowded gatherings are being limited, people are being asked to wear masks. And I think that if we think about 100 years from now, the records that we have saved from COVID, I hope will be helpful in terms of informing policy decisions and informing city officials and community responses if we are ever to experience a pandemic like this again.
So I'm going to play two pieces of sound that seemingly don't go together, but they will, all right? One is a piece of sound you sent over from the 1918 archive, and this is Pietrina Maravigna, who lived with her family in the North End in 1918, talking about that time.
During the time that I can remember, during the times of the influenza, people helped each other. I know in our particular building, we had one family, there were three members who had contracted the illness. And I know my father went down there with soup, and then the three of them died, and we took the two children in. But that was the kind of a feeling, because they were the kind of a people that you wanted to do these things for, and they would have done it for you.
So it's striking for a couple of reasons. One, just, oh my gosh, to hear this voice from 1918 and bring it forward, and how many conversations like that we heard in the early days of the pandemic here. But also, she talks about people wanting to show up for each other, do things for each other. And of course, we've had a mask controversy in this pandemic. Masks were pushed back on heartily in 1918 as well. And our relationships and understanding about masks also changed over time. You've touched on that, but now here's the other piece of sound, right? Here's Marty Walsh teaching people how to make a mask from a t-shirt.
And then you would just fold it over like that, and then you pick it up, and basically you have a mask. You put it on, there you go. Not too bad.
Which I love the sound of him looking over his face right at the end of that. And of course, later, those kinds of masks, not effective at all. Right? So all of these little hash marks of then and now, the way it changed, the spirit that we had towards each other and didn't have toward each other, it feels like it takes an archive to remind us of the full complexity of these stories.
Absolutely. Both 1918 and then the COVID pandemic that we have been living through are extremely complicated and complex stories. And I think it's really important for us to save a wide variety of records. So individual recollections and reminiscences, like the clip that you just played from 1918, as well as the official government documentation of Mayor Walsh, you know, making a mask, reading bedtime stories to children.
And I'm just going to pause you for a second. People couldn't see, obviously, there's radio, they don't see the video, but it was one of those t-shirts that was branded for Boston, right? And so when he folded it up and used the rubber bands, the logo on the t-shirt fit straight. So you were like advertising for the city at the same time with
yes.
the mask. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's a great visual. But I think that having this history is very helpful because there are commonalities between what happened in 1918 and what happened in 2020 and 2021. In 19, there was an anti-mask league. People were pushing back against masking. There were heated city council debates in cities across the country. Something that didn't happen in 2020 is that in 1918, people were actually jailed for refusing to wear masks. Of course, that's a difference between what happened in 2020 and 2021. But I think that it can build resilience for us to realize that, our country, our society has been through this before. I was talking to some students at the Mozart School in Rosendale about pandemic history and showing them documentation of masks that we have. And one of them said, oh, so my great-grandparents had to wear masks too. And I said, yeah, that's right. Your great-grandparents probably were asked to wear masks. That's something you have in common with them.
So, Marta, you know, you're an archivist for reference and outreach at the city. We're 3 years to the day when the first case is found in Massachusetts. And I have to admit, I just got to say this out loud. Hearing these sounds, talking with you about this, I love it and I hate it. I don't want to be back there, right? And yet we have to be back there. Mm-hmm. On that day, did you say, well, I guess I better get busy?
It took me a few weeks, to be honest, because like everyone else, I was shocked, scared, worried for my family. I have healthcare workers in my family. And something that we realized actually when we were doing this documentation was that everyone in city government was doing their best to mitigate the crisis. And so we couldn't ask them to provide us with documentation.
They were busy doing it.
Yeah, they were busy doing it. And any extra energy they had was being expended on taking care of their families, their loved ones, themselves. And so we looked for ways to document what was happening without adding an extra burden to city workers and officials who were on the front lines. And that happened a couple of weeks into the pandemic.
And one of the ways that you could do that is grab this material that the city was producing. So we promised earlier in our conversation we'd play a little bit of Mayor Marty Walsh, then mayor, reading. This is When I Get Bigger by Mercer Mayor.
When I get bigger, I'll be able to do lots of things. I'll go to the corner store all by myself and spend my allowance on anything I want. I'll wait until the light is green, then I'll look both ways for cars before I cross the street.
And a moment that really hit me is when he finished that book, he said to his staff, yeah, I want to do the giving tree. I think I have it at home. I'll bring it another time, right? These moments of reality that you capture while he's doing it, which is because we were in such an unprecedented time, recording children's books because everyone was stuck at home, right? To keep us connected and read to kids. So now, who gets to see this?
So these are public records. They are available to the public. Some of these records, for example, Twitter feeds that we harvested and archived, you can get just by going to our digital repository. Other records you would have to email us for, and we would send them to. But these are records that belong to the city of Boston. People from Boston or anywhere can access them now. And they will be available, in 100, 200 years. And again, we hope that these are records that will inform future policy decisions, future community responses.
All right. Marta Crilly is an archivist for reference and outreach for Boston City Archives. I continue personally to think that what you do is just fascinating. Thank you for bringing pieces of it to us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's more ahead. When we come back to conversation, we'll be speaking with three pastors who want us to remove the name Faneuil from Faneuil Hall. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Let me ask you something. Where do you take visitors when they come to see Boston? Freedom Trail, Paul Revere's house, Old North Church, Faneuil Hall. Also known as the Cradle of Liberty, Faneuil Hall is iconic for its role in the Revolution. Samuel Adams and the Sons of Liberty meeting there multiple times to discuss the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party. An estimated 20 million people pass through the marketplace every year. But it is also iconic for its role in enslavement. And for that reason, some want to erase the name of the man who built and donated it to the city, Peter Faneuil. Three of those advocates are here with us in Studio 2 today. They have staged sit-ins in City Hall, chained themselves to Faneuil Hall, even gone on a hunger strike. Reverend Kevin Peterson is founder of the New Democracy Coalition. Pastor Valerie Copeland is pastor of the Neighborhood Church of Dorchester. And Reverend John Gibbons is the community minister for Good Trouble at Arlington Street Church of Boston. Reverend Peterson, welcome back.
Oh, good to be here.
Pastor Copeland, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Reverend Gibbons, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm going to start with not the question I was going to ask, but Valerie Copeland, you chuckled when I said, where do you bring people? And you're like, I know where this is going. This is an interesting monument that we are talking about because we know its whole history, but we visit one part of its history.
And I'm going to say, let's start with defining we. As an African-American person who's lived in Boston all of her life, I don't bring my visitors to Faneuil Hall because there's nothing there for them to see. When you visit Faneuil Hall, you see very few people of color. And in fact, I've had people question me when they have come, right? When they come on business or they come with their white friends, they'll often say, where are the black people, right? So there's no evidence of black community, black society, black history, black culture prevalent anywhere at Faneuil Hall.
So that's such an important point, Reverend Kevin Peterson, because if we think about the back and forth on this since, I would say, roughly 2017, when mm-hmm. you really started to push mm-hmm. for the change in the name at Faneuil Hall, the back and forth often is, why do you want to take away something that many can see clearly for its full truth and want as a landmark of who we are in Boston? But Valerie Copeland is saying, not even that's right. Right? Faneuil Hall is important for part of Boston, but not for all of
Boston.
Well,
it's not a takeaway. It's an add to, really. It's a way that we enhance our history. It's a way that we look at the past in order to examine the present and dig down into or engage what the future of Boston should look like. So when we talk about changing the name of Faneuil Hall, we're talking about engaging in deep conversations about race and racial reconciliation in Boston. It's not a symbolic move, but it's a move towards having a deeper dialogue about the structure of racism, which exists in Boston in 2023, but certainly had some of its genesis in the 1700s when Faneuil Hall was constructed. We call it Slave Traders Hall because Peter Faneuil was a white supremacist, a person who owned slaves, a bigot. And we don't believe that it's proper for our city officials and we as citizens to support the name of a publicly owned building after a person such as Peter Faneuil. So we want to change the name. It's a little complicated. We want to change the name in order to dig deeper into what we can be as a city moving forward as Boston approaches its 400th anniversary.
So a little context for listeners mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. So Peter Faneuil, wealthy local businessman, traded in goods mm-hmm. that were produced via the slave trade, enslaved people himself, mm-hmm. Funded and built this building with his own name on it, mm-hmm. gave it to the city. And it's also important to note, and Reverend John Gibbons, I'm going to turn to you here, it's also important to note that actually auctions of human beings were held in vicinity of Faneuil Hall as well. I'm going to turn to you here because you're white. Today is the first day of Black History Month. We are going to have a number of conversations over the next month here on Radio Boston, centering Black voices, Black actions in our city. Reverend Copeland or Pastor Copeland and Reverend Peterson have just situated this for us. As a white pastor, how are you talking to white communities who say, oh, great, so now we're just going to change the name of everything?
Sometimes Kevin has referred to me as a mercenary in this campaign, and I'll take that because I think that this is an issue that affects all people of all races, suburban communities as well as urban communities. I side with Martin Luther King, who said that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. And I would also take slight exception to your introduction, Tiziana, in saying that we would erase the name of Faneuil. We want people to know the actual history of Peter Faneuil. Yes, he was a wealthy merchant whose sole claim to fame was his wealth garnered on the backs of human beings and human trafficking. And he cited his building on the site of the first auction block for enslaved people in Boston. The building of Faneuil Hall was controversial at the time because he wanted to centralize markets in one building, and that pushed out many of the poorer vendors and allowed the wealthier merchants a space. And that continues to be the legacy of Peter Faneuil, that he has erased the history of the people that were enslaved on that very site.
So I'll turn to you, Valerie Copeland. I'm going to play a little bit of sound here from WCVB Channel 5.
Protesters staging a sit-in at City Hall in Boston. As you can see, some have been arrested hours after City Hall closed for the day. They are demanding a name change for Faneuil Hall.
So as I was preparing for today and reviewing all of the steps, starting from, you know, your first actions, Kevin Peterson, in 2017 forward, it feels, honestly, it feels striking that this much social action has made so little dent in city response. It doesn't feel like what I'm used to seeing. Can you talk about that? Because you've put yourself in these protests.
It is disheartening to have our political representatives dismiss our voices and our complaint. As citizens, as voters, as activists, as clergy, standing in the margins for justice, for equality, and all we have asked for is a conversation and a meeting. And it is hard to be in this position where we have put a lot of our physical capital, a lot of labor, planning, strategy, and work to still be in a place where we have not been able to have a meeting to discuss something that we believe is important, particularly as we've just had the celebration about the embrace, right? We cannot completely move forward without going back. And so part of this has to do with, if we talk about racial reconciliation, economic reparations, it also has to do with repairing the narrative and whose voices get to be featured in history and the erasure that continues, right? And so in order to really move forward, we really need to have a conversation about what we need to reclaim from the past, what we need to repair, so that we can have, so that we can enter into the future having dealt with and remedied some of the harm that's been done.
So I want to crystallize this moment because the sound that we played, you were sitting in at City Hall into the evening looking for a meeting with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. That was on a Thursday. The following Monday was our Mondays with the mayor. Mayor Wu sits exactly in the seat you're sitting in, Valerie, on Monday once a month. Yeah. We asked her about this. Kevin Peterson, here are pieces of what she said to us.
Unfortunately, it's not such that I have the time where if someone just comes and camps out somewhere that will jump to the head of the line. We are very intentional about how to ensure that the priorities that I promise to carry out in this office are the priorities that I can help move forward. Team members have met with this group. I am briefed on every conversation that and every bit of information that is intended for me from those meetings, and it is just as effective as meeting with me directly.
So a very long no.
And it's not true.
And it, oh, so, okay. It's not what I was going to ask you, but do that first.
Well, it's not true. First of all, we've sent at least four different letters to the mayor, about which there could have been a response of some kind from the mayor. A form letter would and some on some level be acceptable. But there is no truth to her assertion that her team members met with us.
Okay, so she acknowledged those letters, and her assertion was that Shagun Idowu has been in conversation with you.
He walked through the protest on that evening. That was almost accidental, as he explained it. So there has been no coordination between our group and the mayor's office in terms of a sit-down as to what we're trying to do. What they have described us as trying to do is engage in symbolism that has no substance, when in fact we're talking about having substantive questions about racial inequality in the city, about which she seeks to govern fairly. And without taking in this full history of Black people and the crisis that they face every day, she's not being fair. She's alluding the difficult conversations around race, that materialize every day in our city. We saw on Sunday, I stood over the blood of a 13-year-old boy on Sunday in Mattapan.
We talked to Isaac Diablo yesterday about this.
There is no way for me to disconnect what I witnessed on Sunday, the blood on the ground, in 2023, disconnect that from the legacy of racism, of structural inequality, of the crisis that black people have experienced since the days of Faneuil Hall. So if Mayor Wu wants to dress this up as something that's not important or that's that is on the margins of her concerns, then she's woefully misunderstands what black people go through every day and how it's connected to a longer history about which I believe she has no deep connection at this point.
So a couple of things there. First, mm-hmm. I think we have to acknowledge that there is a bit of a it's almost hard to keep the conversation going on the drop the mic moment of the bloody death of a 13-year-old. Yeah. And so I want to center that moment, respect it, recognize it, and I want to have a little more conversation on the thing that we're talking about, and I want to make it very clear that...
Well, I want to say that there's no disconnection, Tiziana, and no disrespect to you.
Yeah, and I'm attempting no disrespect to
you. But if you don't get, if you're not a black person, if you're... if you're not a black person, you may miss the connection that a lot of black people will make in terms of their lived reality in this city and how there is no disconnection between the first black people being brought here as slaves and the degree to which black people are treated in 2023. There's no disconnection. So although you're trying to center, and I appreciate that, we're on radio, we don't have much time, but the point that Mayor Wu is missing is that there are structural inequalities embedded in the city about which she attempts to govern without paying due deference and respect to that history. And we're trying to bring it to her attention, as we did with the last mayor, so it's not personal.
No, I mean,
but we tried to do this with Mayor Walsh. And
you didn't eat for 7 days trying
right.
to get Boston Mayor Marty Walsh
right.
to pay attention to this. Thank you for that. And I'm going to turn now back to John Gibbons for just a moment, because, again, part of this conversation is Kevin Peterson saying to me, I'm white. I may not fully understand the depth of connection of history from those moments before Faneuil Hall was built all the way to our most recent devastation in Mattapan on Sunday. That is a conversation for the white community in mm-hmm. Boston, too, who are
That's
the
right.
families that bring people to Faneuil Hall. So, with a minute left in Radio Boston today, challenge the white community for the conversation you want the white community to have this month.
Absolutely. Faneuil Hall and Quincy Market remain, as has been said, an embarrassingly white space. And that is not the image that Boston would wish to project into the future. We feel that the name of Peter Faneuil chains us to a history and, as Pastor Valerie said, a narrative that is false. We would want the history of Peter Faneuil to be known in all of its ugliness, and we would hope that we have a name that would call us, beckon us into the future. And that is something that should appeal to all people, white and black, all people of color in the city of Boston and beyond.
I want to give you the last word, Reverend Peterson. We have 50 seconds left on the show.
Well, only to make this point, in terms of governance for Mayor Wu, who pays attention to polls, Mass Inc. released a poll late last year, saying that 51% of all Bostonians now agree to changing the name of Faneuil Hall. She should follow the polls or have that give her a little guidance. Last point I want to make is that we would not have anything in Boston called Hitler Hall. Maybe we should make a similar analogy in terms of renaming
okay.
Faneuil Hall.
Kevin Peterson is from New Democracy Coalition. Valerie Copeland is with Neighborhood Church of Dorchester. And John Gibbons is with the Arlington Street Church. Thank you to all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
That's the show. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.